morning. At the Capitol this hour, supporters of the bills to mandate pesticide disclosure are gathering. One of them is set for decision-making today. It has the support of a Kauai woman, and we'll talk about her personal experiences working for a hospital. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Protecting Kahoolawe from vessels that might come too close could come with a stiff penalty, the forfeiture of the boat. KIRC Executive Director Michael Naho'opi'i considers why the bill would fit the crime. It's Tuesday, March 3rd. From HPR2, it's The Conversation.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. This morning, a documentary filmmaker looks at soil, how we treat it in cultures around the world, and the essential role it plays in our lives, whether we know it or not. And children's books authors and illustrators gather at UH Manoa to hone their craft.
All that starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
I guess Kahoolawe would have to be described as an island that has become so much more than an island because of its history, yeah?
Because of its history and because of some of the efforts that we've already seen happen, yeah. And the wish for those who have been trying to protect the island to keep those efforts continuing. And that means money and also means legislation that's got some teeth. And that's what we're going to talk about first thing this morning. Would the penalty fit the crime? That's the essential question behind a bill to allow the forfeiture of an asset or natural resources used or taken from Kahoolawe. Opponents say the value of many vessels isn't equal to the possibility of inadvertently getting too close to the island. That would be within 1 nautical mile of it. But those who support the bill believe that it's stiff for a reason, to keep away people who would poach from the island and impact its frail environment. Michael Naho'opi'i is the executive director of the Kahoolawe Island Reserve Commission, and he's returning to our studio today with an update on this and other bills to protect the island. Good morning. Thanks for coming in again.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and thank you for having me back again.
Well, when we first talked at the beginning of the session, there were many things on the table. Those have been winnowed down a little bit. But interestingly, this bill, although it's undergone a revision, it still has a great deal of teeth to it. And this bill didn't just come out of, you know, the air. This is really based on an experience from 2008 that people may not remember.
Yes. Back in 2008, while we're patrolling around the island, we saw a helicopter land on the island in one of our remote beaches. We approached the helicopter pilot and talked to him and his passengers and asked them if they were in danger or they had emergency problems or any health problems, medical problems. And they said no. They landed on the island because they thought it was a nice place to have lunch. Eventually, the conservation enforcement officers cited them for trespass onto the island, and the Maui prosecutor's office initiated a case to seize the helicopter as asset forfeiture as part of the crime that they committed of trespass. At the same time, later that year, the state Supreme Court made a decision that unless your statute or an agency statute has asset forfeiture as one of its rules, then that provision cannot be used. So the helicopter was returned, and they were just cited for simple trespass, which is about a $100 fine or something. Very, very little teeth in preventing people from illegally entering into the reserve.
So since that time, you've been trying to correct that. And this bill, I mean, this is not the first time that we've seen a bill like this, but this time it seems like it's moving, or is that just an erroneous perception because we're still a week or so away from crossover?
It's still early to predict the exact outcome of this bill, but there is a lot of emphasis to try to get this back again. And the biggest issue is, you know, in the last time this bill was introduced, we made provisions and negotiated with the fishing community and the boating community to give them a 1 mile buffer. We figure if you are a captain or an able captain of a boat and bringing your vessel over the 7 mile channel to Kahoolawe, you should at least know where 1 mile from the island is. The actual reserve is 2 miles from the shore of Kaho'olawe. So we're giving them a 1 mile buffer to, you know, we'll allow for some navigational error, but we're really concerned about people still poaching within the reserve, even though we have a very strong educational campaign, a permitting system. We try to get out there and talk to people about that the need to preserve Kaho'olawe's resources so that it would be one of the last intact places around the state. And so it won't be overfished like the rest of the oceans of Maui and the other islands. And we have a place that will hopefully its abundance will spill over and repopulate the rest of the areas within the state.
About that grace area of a mile, a nautical mile from the island, of when you say that, you know, a captain or anyone who is worth his salt should know what that looks like, and then to have it on the flip side where you hear from some of them saying, well, you know, our vessels are worth so much, and if, you know, we inadvertently happen to be closer, does that wash with you?
Not really, because, you know, I'm a former naval officer, so I fully understand navigation, seamanship. I've sailed submarines, carriers, every size ship across the ocean, and I never got into a place where I shouldn't have been, and I did that at age of 25. So a lot of these sea captains are very experienced people. The other part of it is the penalty still starts at 2 miles. They are still trespassing in the reserve. The agreement that we've had from before was we won't take your vessel. We won't take the vessels, but we will still cite you for trespassing within the 2 mile limit. We do have provisions. If you are in distress, you have a medical emergency that you need to come to the reserve, we just ask that you put away your fishing lines, stop fishing, contact us. We can come and help you if you need help. And when you're restored, just head back out to sea again.
How much is your issue with trying to make it understood that this is a serious issue and it should have a serious penalty behind it? How much is that like other groups who are trying to protect other parts of Hawaii?
Well, across Hawaii, we see in the paper, you know, people are killing monk seals. People are taking natural resources from the forest. People are trespassing on state property in order and damaging state property. As more and more people come to Hawaii and live in Hawaii, and there's more and more pressure from development within Hawaii, the natural resources of Hawaii become more and more scarce. And we need to protect those limited resources that we still have for the enjoyment of not just the people today and for our visitors, but also for our future children who will be needing those resources to be able to live and survive on this island. So we want to make it serious that you have to protect what we have now today.
So if SB 470 SD1 passes, that could be potentially a model for other organizations?
Yes, it could. It would be a way that people can see this this enforcement ability used in a small scale and then be able to observe and take lessons learned from our application of it and to spread out within the rest of the state.
I want to leave this for a second and just sort of give a chance for you to give an overview of what's been happening with some of the other bills relative to Kaho'olawe that we talked about in the beginning, especially about money, how you're going to be able to function after this point or when you know that money has been dwindling for many years now.
Yeah, so from our last discussion, we operate under a trust fund that was established almost 20 years ago. And after 20 years, that trust fund will be pretty much close to expired by the end of this calendar year. We've come to the legislature for many years looking for seeking funding to help us support our operations and our work over, you know, the long period of time that it takes to restore Kaho'olawe. We're getting a lot of support this year, but it is a very tight fiscal period. We had a three-prong approach. We looked at funding in the budget. We looked at funding from a direct appropriation. And we also looked at a portion of the conveyance tax. We've been successful in two of them. The conveyance tax has been, our bill has not been heard for this session, but there has been a lot of movement and a lot of changes going on in the conveyance tax world. So we're kind of glad we're not getting involved and caught in the middle of that big debate about conveyance tax. But there is a lot of support in the legislature. We're finding a lot of support with the governor and everyone out there. So we hope by the end of this year, this legislative calendar, that we'll have sufficient funding to continue on for the next 2 years and we'll be back again.
Well, yeah, because 2 years is maybe some breathing room for you. But as you look out over 2 years, if in fact you get funding to carry you through that period, what do you see might have to happen for you to be able to have more dependable funding? Or do you think you're going to be endlessly caught in this cycle, as are many other organizations, to seek help from the ledge?
Well, our biggest goal is become sustaining. And that is, I think, that's the message that we received from our leadership in Hawaii, is that all different organizations need to become self-sustaining, finding unique revenue sources. We hope that the whatever funding that we can get this year will allow us to be a bridge to the future, for us to develop sustainable or revenue generation within the island, looking at ways that we can perpetuate what we're doing out there through partnerships, through other organizations helping us, and also sharing the burden of managing Kahoʻolawe.
So specifically, can you give me an idea of what that revenue stream might look like?
Well, we're hoping, you know, one of the things that we've gotten the feedback on is, you know, we don't want to, the legislature doesn't want us to go to them with an open hand. They want to see that we are trying to also help ourselves. And we still haven't really figured out exactly what would be relevant to the reserve. But simple things as educational opportunities on the island, having school, developing an educational program on the island where we could at least collect tuition or fees for people to come to Kahoʻolawe and learn about the cultural historical resources for the island.
Well, we'll be watching and seeing what happens, starting with the bill that we're looking at today and then the longer range plan that you've just been talking about. Thanks for coming back in.
And thank you for keeping us here at the station. And we also want to support what the radio station is doing for the community.
Well, thanks very much. Michael Nahoʻopiʻi is the executive director of the Kahoʻolawe Island Reserve Commission. He is a longtime Protect Kahoʻolawe Ohana member and a former U.S. Navy officer in charge of Kahoʻolawe during the conveyance of the island to the state of Hawaii. He was a senior manager during the early model cleanup and later of the Navy Unexploded Ordnance Clearance Project. SB 470, SD 1, the bill we were talking about most of the segment. This hearing on that happens this morning at 9:15 in Conference Room 16. This is The Conversation on Statewide Member Support at HPR2. It's 8:16. Later in the show, a documentary filmmaker looks at the soil beneath our feet, and its links to, well, just about everything. But first, your backyard quiz. Today we're digging into the not-so-recent past to learn about the scientific discovery yielded after land managers worked to restore habitats native to the Pearl Harbor National Wildlife Refuge System. In 2005, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began a project to restore antiline pools within the Kalaeloa unit of the wildlife refuge, Barbers Point. The pools had been filled with rocks and sediment to make way for development. Excavation of the area began with the hope they could provide habitat for the Hawaiian volcano shrimp and the orange-black damselfly, both of which are endangered. During the restoration of the pools, biologists came across an amazing find. For today's quiz, can you tell us what they uncovered? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Hi, good morning. I'm Kurt Sui from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Most of the planet is not living. It's mineral, it's never known life. It's just this rock. And yet soil starts forming on it and creates this very thin layer where life is possible.
Soil is a kind of link between the animate and the inanimate. It's born as rock, lifeless, until it transforms over centuries into what we know as soil, a complex array of organisms teeming with life. Deborah Coons Garcia is a filmmaker who looked at the essential role soil occupies in our lives and in the life of our planet. She tells its story in Symphony of the Soil, a documentary she's bringing to Maui. And as she told us the other day, Hawaii is an ideal living laboratory to tell that story.
Most soil starts off as rock, and then microorganisms and plants and then animals work on it to turn it into the living organism, that soil. And what's particularly interesting and should be interesting to people who come and see the film in Maui is that Hawaii is a great place to study the life cycle of soil. And soil scientists all over the world know that. It's a place where on the Big Island you have soil that's 50 years old, you know, made from tephra that came out of the volcano. And then on Kauai you have soil that's 5 million years old.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating place to really understand that, which is what we do in a part of the film, early in the film. It's the birth of soil and then the sort of the life cycle of soil. And we had a wonderful trip in Hawaii where we did that.
Because on Hawaii Island you can see soil as liquid, before it becomes soil, as liquid rock, yeah?
Right, yeah. The tephra and all those minerals in it get, you know, that's what gets worked into the soil. And ultimately those minerals go into the food that we eat, and we get those minerals and helps build our bodies.
And you mentioned, you referred to soil as a living entity, which I think most people wouldn't necessarily understand, but if you pick up a handful of soil, there's lots going on in there, isn't there?
Yeah, it really is an organism, and it has and that was one of the things that I used as I figured out how to make the film. So sort of soil as a protagonist of our planetary story, and it's a living organism. It has a birth, it has a life cycle, there are different characteristics to it, and we have a relationship with it. And it is quite a remarkable substance. And there's processes going on within it and cycles and currents, and it's just, you know, it's funny because you look at it, it looks like there's nothing going on, but when you really understand it, you know, you look at it, you realize there's just so much going on just in one clump of soil even.
But human beings, Deborah, have a tendency to mistreat living organisms, don't they? Don't we?
Well, you know, I think that you know, the soil, you know, there's a thing that, you know, people say you treat soil like dirt. You know, dirt is the four-letter word for soil scientists. They like it to be called soil and not dirt. Dirt,
yeah.
You think of as dead soil. But, yeah, we, you know, and even though soil has a remarkable capacity to recover and you know, and remain alive, you can kill it. And that's what's unfortunately happening in some of the practices that we humans are doing. You know, I think that agriculture itself can be problematic. But I think that most humans, it's curious, I think once we focus on soil, we become fascinated by it because there's something instinctive, innate in humans that make us want to look at soil and understand it, because for all those years that we were hunter-gatherers, those hundreds of thousands of years, we actually had to do that to survive. So there's part of our survival mechanism that's like, yes, I think I do want to look at this soil and understand it.
One of the things that struck me was an interview with a chef who basically says that it takes good soil to make good-tasting food.
Absolutely, and we have the wonderful chef Dan Barber in the film at Stone Barns, which is outside of New York, and they actually grow their own food, and that's one of the things that he says. And a lot of chefs really understand that. I mean, I think cooks have understood that, and chefs have understood it forever.
Sure.
But, yeah, I mean, that's how you get the flavor in food, is all those, you know, different nutrients and minerals and things that are in the soil. That's what actually gives flavor. And that's why wine that's grown in you know, that's the whole thing with wine, is terroir, is what soil is it grown in that gives the wine that particular characteristic. So it's very very different eating something that's been grown in soil that's alive and has had the organic matter and all the minerals and things returned to it than something that's been grown basically on life support using irrigation and chemicals. Very, very different flavor, and also, I think, a very different effect on our bodies.
And we're seeing a pretty big return to vermiculture, composting, to an understanding of all the things you talk about in your film, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. And all that is about is returning, especially the composting, returning carbon to the soil. Because, you know, when we grow food, we take the food off that land and remove it, so it's not being returned to the soil. And there's a principle that we talk about in the film, and that many, you know, many farmers and soil scientists know. It's called the law of return, and Sir Albert Howard sort of came up with a name for that. He's a British farmer and agronomist back in the last century. But the idea is, in nature, a leaf falls from a tree and then on the ground underneath the tree, and that's broken down by microorganisms, and all those nutrients are returned to the soil so that they can be taken up by plants in the next cycle. So when you take everything off the field and you don't return anything to it, you're really going to have diminished nutrition as well as taste and everything else. But all these things of composting, vermiculture, even things like cover crops, which are traditional but now farmers are returning to them, all those things help keep the soil in a more, the more we mimic nature in agriculture, the better. The film Symphony of the Soil is actually only partly about agriculture. It sees agriculture from the point of view of soil rather than seeing a soil from the point of view of agriculture, which is, you know, a little bit different. So it really looks at soil health, and it's not so much about what can we get out of it, you know, what's in it for us. It's about soil on its own and what a miraculous substance it is that supports us.
In a way, agriculture is supporting the soil rather than the other way around.
Well, I think the best agriculture does do that, because that's best for the long run, in the long term. And if you keep degrading soil to the point where it's, you know, it's very, very poor soil, your crops aren't going to grow very well. I mean, they don't have anything, you know, nothing's going to feed them, just like people, if they don't have proper enough nutrition or the proper things that they need to grow into healthy adults, for example, for children.
That's the whole flaw of short-term thinking, isn't it, Deborah?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think that there are certain aspects of our agricultural system now that reward a short-term return instead of a long-term, you know, health of the soil. And that's one of the reasons why I made the film. I made a film called The Future of Food that came out 11 years ago. That was actually really popular in Hawaii. And that sort of made me realize that if we want a healthy food future, we really have to focus on the soil.
Deborah Coons Garcia is a filmmaker who will present her film Symphony of the Soil at the McCoy Theater at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center Friday, March 13th. She'll also discuss it afterward, and it's a presentation of the Merwin Conservancy's Green Room. You can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Mr. Netanyahu goes to Washington.
American leaders worry about the security of their country. Israeli leaders worry about the survival of their country.
Israel's leader tries to kill the chance for a nuclear deal with Iran in a speech before Congress. Who is running U.S. foreign policy? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
S is for sustainability. Listeners who've become sustaining members know that providing the station ongoing monthly gifts allows HPR to plan and invest in innovative new ideas. We gratefully acknowledge new sustaining members Garrett Webb of Kailua Kona, Cecilia Fordham of Honolulu, and Matt Johnson of Kailua. Join them in sustaining HPR by calling 955-8821 during business hours, or you can follow the support link at hawaiipublicradio.org. 1,300 acres of West Oahu prime agricultural land could soon be converted to housing. If that happens, will there be enough farmland left to produce the increased amount of fruit and vegetables Sustainability Organization and the state's 2050 plan are advocating? Civil Beat's Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
That seems to be the bottom line question. Do we have enough ag land to do what we say we want to do by 2050? And the question to that, does it have an answer?
Well, Anita Hofschneider looked into this situation because you're right. We say that we want land so that we can sustain ourselves, so we don't have to import whatever it is now, 85% or more of our food needs. But when you have a project like Ho'opili, which has a council vote this week on rezoning that 1,300 acres you talked about of prime ag land, when you do that and you put in 12,000 homes between Eva and Kapolei, that only eats up the land that you so desire to preserve for sustainability, for agricultural purposes. So Anita took a look at this, and it turns out not only are we eating up that prime ag land, but we're not even sure exactly how much there is in the state.
And that seems to be another real issue, that to say that we need to have ag land, how much ag land do we need? We don't even know how much we really have. How can that be?
Well, there is some confusion in terms of the studies that are out there, even though, back in 1978, we had a constitutional amendment saying we're supposed to identify important ag lands. But Anita took a look at some of the studies. One of them, the most recent, is actually by someone who was working for D.H. Horton. The developer also has a background working for Castle and Cook and Campbell Estate, so one wonders whether the data is suspect. But according to this study, there is sufficient land, at least 17 or 18% of Oahu, anyway, remains ag land. But there's some questions about even that. Does that include irrigation, proper access to water? Does that take into account the slope of the land, whether it can actually be harvested or not?
You're really talking about, what is ag land fundamentally?
Right, and the Sierra Club is among the groups that is really concerned that we're not exactly able to precisely define what ag land is. They actually call this alarming, particularly with projects like Ho'opili, which in all likelihood is going to be approved by the council, are going forward, not without protest. There were folks out Monday night complaining to the council about, well, what are you doing with all our ag land?
Have there been any other organizations that have been looking at this? I'm thinking about the Ulupono Initiative. Anyone else taking some sort of measured approach to it?
They have, and Ulupono, of course, is an independent organization, and then there's the state and the county that have looked into it as well. But there is no precise data. I think that's the conclusion that Anita came to, which is, I think, the main point to take away when developers are coming and proposing that we rezone other ag land for real estate purposes. No precise study, certainly not one that's up to date.
So the big takeaway of this is that we're acting without information that might be critical to the decision that we're now considering making.
Well, if we want to be self-sustaining, if we want to grow our own food, or remember Hawaii was a huge producer of agriculture for decades, sugarcane, pineapple, and whatnot. Big question as to whether we can do that again. Once you take away the land, it's gone.
You're telling me more about paving paradise, are you?
Thank you, Joni Mitchell.
All right. I know you like her. All right, Chad. We'll have to wait and see what happens later this week when this comes up for hearing again, but we'll see what happens with it.
Thanks, Bethann.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting the comedy Peter and the Starcatcher, a prequel to J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan for audiences 10 years and up, opening this Thursday. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
Today, the contentious issue of mandatory pesticide disclosure may continue to make its way toward law. Supporters are holding a rally at this hour in advance of the Senate Ways and Means decision-making on SB 1037. Kauai resident Lorna Cummings Poe was scheduled to be there. She has been unable to make the trip. although she has long advocated for greater pesticide regulation. In part, she says her stance is directly related to her experience while working for Kauai Hospital when kids and teachers came into the ER following a chemical spraying in 2008. And Lorna Cummings Poe joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Aloha, good morning.
The groups that are in favor of this bill have said that there are at least 24 schools across the state which have less than half a mile from areas where those restricted pesticides are being applied. Was that the case with your family?
It was that case in Waimea at Waimea Canyon School. I believe that my family that lives on the west side is a little closer because the residential areas aren't as protected either.
So when you were in working for the hospital in 2008, we should say that you work in the billings department, the coding department, so
yes.
You were privy to seeing what, you know, the doctors had written up on those reports and how they would be reflected in charges. And without, you know, breaking any confidentiality, can you speak a little bit to what you saw coming through as you were seeing, you know, kids come through the ER?
Well, the school is no more than 25 to 30 yards away from the hospital. Actually, it's right next door, separated by a driveway. So the EMTs brought the children in through the emergency room and teachers with symptoms of nausea and dizziness, headaches, and I believe a few of them even needed some IV. But it was very, very disturbing. And it was actually my initial, I was able to be educated on what was happening. I wasn't aware of what was taking place on the west side until that time.
So what changed that for you? I mean, just seeing all these kids come through and hearing their responses to the question of, you know, what happened. How did you get that information? What happened for you?
How did I get the information?
Well, I mean, you were there watching children come through, and obviously your experiences with billing for them and seeing what the doctors had written. But how did you go from that point and watching that? You say it was your first real understanding of what was going on.
Just to following the media and the results of the Department of Health and Department of Agriculture's findings, just being angered at what their responses were. They sort of pushed it over as a stinkweed problem. And, you know, stinkweed's been growing on the west side for many years, and we've never had reactions to it in the past. So it was pretty obvious that it was a big cover-up. And at that point, I started to watch what was happening in our community and watch closely what the chemical companies are doing or were doing at the time on the island and how it was just overtaking the west side with their fields.
As you were watching this and being able to get any sort of information about what was being sprayed?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We were told what they were spraying, but not enough information to actually prove that the symptoms that were caused by the spraying would justify any. Justify the need for us to diagnose, for the doctors to diagnose those symptoms and relate it to pesticide spraying. So this is why we need disclosure.
When you have, though, some knowledge of what was spayed, because there's still that Kauai Good Neighbor program that's been in effect at least for the last, 13 months or so, that you've been able to get some information about this?
Right, very little information, though not enough to determine the causes of the illnesses that are occurring on the west side.
So,
and
go ahead.
We only know what the outcomes of all the spraying of the different chemicals and how it reacts to the human body.
Have you been able to look at some of those chemicals and see some of the studies about them? I mean, you say you have very little information about them, but are there studies that you've looked at?
There are some reports that, you know, organizations, especially those against the spraying, have gathered, you know. But, you know, the West Side community is so inundated with test fields that the spraying is just tremendously high, and the overspray is just horrible. It's affecting neighborhoods and schools, hospitals, parks, and everywhere that our children play and spend their time. And, you know, their metabolism is such that they accept these poisons much easier, and there's a lot of medical diagnosis that could be related to the spraying.
So at this point, have you been able to chronicle so much of that overspray and those incidents of where that's happening in the schools and in the parks and in other areas where children play?
Yes, it's chronicled, but it's not proven.
And so that seems to be the chronic link that people are looking for is how do you say this is happening and then attribute it to the overspray? And you're saying that it looks like it's a logical thing in your mind because the kids are there, they're coming in with these, presenting with symptoms, and you know that the
right.
spraying is going on. So you'd like to be able to have more information about what those chemicals really are as they're being sprayed.
Exactly. We need disclosure. We really need disclosure. You know, we're not asking them to stop. We're not asking the chemical companies to stop. We just want them to disclose. We want them to be truly good neighbors. And, you know, the incidence of illness on the west side of Kauai is just tremendous. We have so many people dying of cancer. We have a very high birth defect rate. We have just autism. Doctors are diagnosing a lot of illnesses that could be relative to pesticide spray.
And all your
it's not happening on the other side of the island frequently either.
And so that's why you say that you need to at least know what those pesticides are, so then you can do some additional information about them. As you say, you're not asking the companies to stop. Well,
no.
In about 15 minutes or so, the hearing, the decision-making hearing is going to start, and we'll find out what arguments of the Ways and Means Committee believes. Thanks very much for giving us your time, especially as we know that you're sick today. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and have a wonderful day. Aloha.
Aloha. Lorna Cummings Poe is a lifelong resident of Kauai and a community advocate. She worked in the billing department of a hospital where kids and teachers were sent following episodes of pesticide spraying in 2008, and she believes that her adult children and grandchildren continue to deal with the impact of pesticide drift. And again, as we mentioned this morning, at about 9:05 in Conference Room 211, the Senate Ways and Means Committee is scheduled to make its decision about SB 1037. That's the bill to mandate pesticide disclosure.
Aloha, my name is Denise Russell, and I'm a member of Hawaii Public Radio. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio.
And we just had a call from someone who said that about that last conversation, would we talk to a voice of authority as part of this discussion? We do. We have lots of slices of discussions about various topics, and the one you just heard is just one of them. Now on to our backyard quiz answer. Earlier this morning, we asked you about what biologists unearthed while restoring the Ankeoline pools within the Kalaeloa unit of the Pearl Harbor National Wildlife Refuge. That's at Barbara's Point. In 2005, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began excavating the pools. They'd been filled with rocks and sediment, and they were trying to make way for development by unearthing all of that. The pools had formed around 120,000 years ago and were basically vertical caves that trapped animals and plant pollen that once populated the Eva Plain. Now, during the restoration of the pools, biologists came across an amazing find, and today we asked you if you could name it, and the answer is they found subfossil bones from extinct Hawaiian birds. And those bones were from dozens of extinct species, and they provided evidence that the prehistoric bird population was quite diverse. Bones have been found from flightless rails, a long-legged owl, several kinds of finches, two different species of extinct crow, and the Oahu Moanalo. And thanks to Molly Hagman at the Bishop Museum for today's quiz. It's now 8:47. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you can live inside a child's imagination, you can set your own imagination free. And that's something the authors and illustrators of children's books know well. This weekend, they're gathering at UH Manoa to hone their craft. Sarah Ellis is one of the keynote speakers. She'll be speaking on the craft of the picture book and on the particular challenge posed by the young adult novel. She's online with us now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
One of the things that you're going to be talking about is the whole idea of the picture book as a craft that its authors can really, really call your own. It's one that you've sort of created from scratch, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, other things like the novel have much in common with the adult novel, but the particular art of the picture book and its sort of dance between pictures and words is something that's uniquely our own.
And it's a dance that's adapted to the quite specifically to the age group of its audience, yeah?
That's right. So you can assume in most cases that there's going to be a kind of adult intermediary. So someone will be reading those words that you've written. And in that way, it's a bit like writing a script or a piece of theater or something. Mm-hmm. And that's really fun.
Kind of a storyboard in a sense, yeah?
Yeah, in a way. Yeah, so you really... You know, the structure has to be pretty strong and the story has to be important, but after that, you can really be playful.
Well, and then when you're reading a picture book to a child, reading and showing a picture book to a child, you have that sort of pause at each page where the child can kind of create his or her own pictures.
That's right, and often the adult reader also adds things of their own, so it becomes kind of a very personalized text. You know, you can throw in the kid's name or where they live or even gestures, you know, where you bang the page at a particular moment or something. And that is often, it's like the kid is participating in making the story.
And that's part of the craft, I would think, in setting up situations for parents and children to do that, huh?
Yeah, like you mentioned, the sort of drama of the turning page. A big part of writing a picture book is deciding where the words are going to go on each page so that you can get the most out of that little moment before you turn the page where the kid can predict or be surprised or whatever.
Because you always want them to dive in, right? It's not passive reading at all.
Right. It's absolutely not passive. It's, I mean, sometimes when you're reading to little kids, they sort of get into it with their bodies, you know, mm-hmm. jumping around and... dancing, and so it is a whole experience.
It which calls for a pretty detailed understanding of children, right?
Yeah, and I think possibly more important is really deep understanding of story.
Sure.
You know, it has to be important in some way, which doesn't mean at all that it has to be solemn, mm-hmm. but when you're talking about real things, kids get it.
we all remember the stories from childhood that pulled us along, whether they be classic stories, fairy tales, or whatever. And I suppose part of it is just figuring out what it was that pulled us along when we were kids, yeah?
Yeah, that's kind of my approach to talking about writing, is trying to figure out, you know, what are the deeper things that got us engaged.
Because there are, I mean, there are classic elements to writing. You know, you can break it down, plot, character, that kind of thing. But understanding the specifics is pretty important, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I think you get that through lots of reading yourself, you know, just get it into your DNA, and then you're free to invent.
Have you found it liberating to your own imagination to have to kind of think like a child or put yourself inside a child's mind?
Yeah, it is. It's you can set a lot of things aside and get into some essentials and really play with language, too, and try and see the world, to get back to seeing the world afresh, as though this is the very first time you've encountered something. And that, you know, that's not just fun as a writer. That is fun as a human being.
Sure. And I think when we're first learning language, we all, we play with it more in the first years of learning it. We listen to it just for
the sound of it. And almost every family, for example, has invented words, mm-hmm. you know, that the kids have made up and then all the adults adopt because they're so enjoyable.
Sure.
Those
the words that we make, again, those first years of encountering language, when there's an excitement about language that, maybe only poets hang on to that throughout their lives, right?
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah.
Well, how do you encourage the things that you have come to understand as being helpful to the author-illustrator? How do you bring out those qualities in other authors in a workshop like this?
Well, we're going to do, I think it's trying to get yourself into the mode of playing, which is, play is serious business for kids, and it's intense, and it's... if you look at a kid playing, they're often completely engaged by that world. The outer world has disappeared for them, and that's kind of the mode that writers get into when it's going well.
Yeah.
Is that you're so focused on the work, and things come up that you couldn't have predicted. So in a workshop, I try to just create circumstances and exercise where people can just start to genuinely play. Excuse me.
Well, because as adults, we tend to devalue play, even though we value work and concentration and being able to focus on our work. But we don't. We've sort of come to see play as something trivial rather than as something essential.
Yeah, we've come to see play as the opposite of work.
Yeah.
Whereas, in fact, for children, they are the same thing.
And even for adults, if you're working really well, if you're really getting something done, it can feel like play. It almost should feel like play.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously not everybody can achieve this for every one of their 8 hours a day, but the moments when you can, I think, are the moments when you're really productive and creative.
I suppose the trick is to recognize when that state of mind is, figuring out ways to get access to that state of mind, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Just try and make the external circumstances welcoming to that. Not that that's a guarantee that it'll happen, but, one of the big things for adults is just taking the time.
Sure.
Since, you know, all of us are so plugged in and multitasking, and to just give yourself the leisure of 45 minutes in which you... play.
Yeah, that's good advice for any writer. Just don't give up. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Okay.
Sarah Ellis will be one of the featured speakers at the CBWI, Children's Book Writers and Illustrators Conference, this Friday and Saturday at UH Manoa's William S. Richardson School of Law. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
On New Letters on the Air, Nikki Giovanni expresses the rich storytelling culture of the Appalachians, where she was born.
Because we're in the mountains, whether black or white, the way that we communicate is through stories. And so I grew up in a storytelling tradition.
Nikki Giovanni continues that tradition while teaching at Virginia Tech. Listen to her poetry and stories on the next New Letters on the Air.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
Chris, you remember the time when Kaho'olawe was being transferred back to the state.
Indeed.
And then the initial focus on trying to rehabilitate it.
Which has been a long and arduous task, and it still isn't done because so much damage was done over so many years of the so-called target aisle, when bombing runs would actually shake, you know, things off of shelves on Maui, and it just went on day after day. That's a lot of damage, and that's part of the reason that Kaho'olawe became a real flashpoint for the Hawaiian Renaissance. It's not just another rock, and that was the message today, that it's not just a place to stop by in your boat and have a sandwich.
Right, or your helicopter, as has happened in 2008. Part of that is, you know, people in some cases don't know what they don't know, but now they're going to have to know if this measure passes, and there's a whole lot of teeth, like the forfeiture of your vessel, be it a helicopter or your boat.
Yeah, there's easier ways to find out, that's for sure.
We're going to see what happens with that one a little later today. That's going to do it for us, though, for the moment. Up tomorrow, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare's president and CEO will be talking about a petition delivery to Congress on Thursday to preserve Social Security and Medicare. We're going to talk to Max Rickman.
And the West Maui Mountains Watershed Partnership takes aim at invasives with volunteer help.
We'd like to hear from you. You can now call our new talkback line. Leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and we tweet at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you could find them on the HPR2 archive, along with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under Talk Shows for the Conversation. On HPR2.org, I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.